With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T, or download the List app on the App Store today.
Maybe you're most publicly recognized as the man who took a bullet for one of our presidents. And I won't hit you up too much on that. I'd rather focus on what you've done for the community of Orland Park.
Well, it's one of those things in policing that you never think is going to happen to you. No one in law enforcement ever thinks anything bad is going to happen to them. But it does sometimes. And in that case, what I'm thankful about is that on that occasion, I was able to do what I was trained to do. Because you don't do it. The normal reaction would be, under those circumstances, to hit the deck. That's what police are trained to do. Seek cover. In the Secret Service, while on protection, though, you're trained to cover the president and evacuate them. And it sounds easy, and you do it in training with simulated attacks and so forth. But like any other critical incident in law enforcement, you don't know if you're going to do it right. You don't know until it happens. And on that occasion, I'm thankful that I was able to do what I was trained to do and, frankly, to be here many years later to tell you about it.
People are still talking about it today. It's become a positive thing that could have been a very, very negative situation. Now, I happen to have you on the phone, so I got to ask you what was going through your head at that moment. Did you see someone approaching, or did you just hear a bullet fire and just immediately jump?
It was, I never saw John Hinckley, but I knew where the shots were coming from, since they were so close, and I simply turned in that direction while other agents to cover the president, to shield the president, while the other agents were shoving him into the armored car. And that was my role at that time. There's different techniques, but at that point, he fired six shots in 1.4 seconds. And immediately afterward, agents and police officers, tackled him and took him to the ground. And that was their role. But those of us on the inner perimeter is to cover the president unless the attacker is within arm's reach, and that wasn't the case, and to evacuate him. So that was a plan, and it, to a certain extent it worked, but it didn't work perfectly because he was shot. It was the fourth round that ricocheted off the right rear quarter panel of the car and went between the door and the frame of the car and hit him under the left armpit. So it wasn't a complete success. But he did survive, and history, fortunately, was not changed in a moment of madness by a lone gunman.
You seem like a very dedicated man to what you do, and we'll get to Orland Park here right after this question, but what inspired you to, get into law enforcement?
Well, my dad was a sergeant in the Chicago Police Department. I grew up in the city where everyone was a policeman or a fireman, and I went to the University of Illinois, played football there, and was a finance major, so I kind of veered away from it for a while in college. But when I got close to graduation, I interviewed with the FBI, the Secret Service, and had planned on taking the test for the Chicago Police Department. Scheduling allowed me to take the test for the Secret Service, and I passed it. And as you probably remember, getting out of college, you're looking for a job. So I was offered the job with the Secret Service, and then, 22 years later, I retired from the Secret Service, after serving 8 years on presidential protection and another 14 in the Chicago field office.
All right, excellent. And then that takes you to Orland Park in 1994. Let's talk about your contributions to the department. I was thinking in my head, you know, I'm like, oh, man, this guy's been in the police department for a long time, and I'm thinking about going through the 70s. But then I realized you're in the 90s where technology is just coming around, and, you know, things are actually really changing within police departments from prior decades. So could you just touch base with me a little bit about what you were able to bring to the community with your leadership?
Well, first it was a change for me, going from federal law enforcement to local law enforcement. But even then, community policing was the new norm, so to speak. And it was important to make that change. So one of the things I did, now I had a great staff, a great police department. We began several dozen different community policing programs immediately to reengage with the community. Such things as beat meetings that are pretty common, cook out with the cops, you know, four or five times a year in the summer. We go to a park, cook hot dogs, cook hamburgers, national night out, all sorts of different senior citizen luncheons, all sorts of different ways to engage with the community. And while I don't think community policing is really, you know, people want to go about their business. I don't think a whole lot of them really want to get too involved with the police, if they don't have to. They don't like getting tickets, we know that. But the community is there for you, and that you have a relationship with the committee, that you build trust with the community. So when things happen, they'll at least give you the benefit of the doubt when something happens, or support you. For example, you know, during the time of this recent civil unrest, you know, our community was coming in with cases of water and Gatorade and gift cards and everything under the sun and letters of support. But you have to build that, and it's easy to lose that too. So the basis of a police department has to be its relationship with the community. It simply has to, with bike patrol, walk and talk, you know, walking beats and things like that, all part of community policing, so that you're meeting with people other than when you're in crisis. So that was, you know, very important, and we accomplished that. But at the same time, you know, technology now in policing, whether it's your CAD system, your basic computer-aided dispatch system, is the vital link, and officers can get so much out of it. License plate readers, cameras, software that you wouldn't even believe, and some of which you have too. I mean, your business is the same way, that if you haven't embraced technology, you've fallen behind. And we have one of my cyber crimes people, two of them, I mean, they're like regional experts, you know, when we get search warrants for cell phones and things like that that have been used in crimes, doing child pornography cases, things of that nature. But police departments, if you haven't embraced technology, then you're going to fall way, way behind and be pretty inefficient along the way.
As you did mention civil unrest, what is your thoughts on the relationship between law enforcement and the community during this period as you step away?
Well, in our community, it's good. It's excellent. We're fortunate we haven't made too many mistakes like that. And we would lose it, too, if we did. We would lose it, too. No question about that. We might get the benefit of the doubt for a period of time. But what happened was tragic. It was illegal. The one good thing we can say about it is that 30 or 40 years ago, it may have ended up differently in the sense that maybe the officer wouldn't have been fired, maybe he wouldn't have been charged. So that part worked. But it never should have happened to begin with. It was outrageous. It is set back. It's the worst tragedy in modern law enforcement from what I can remember. And we've had Laquan McDonald, and we have had the incidents in California. But this is about the worst I've ever seen. And it has set back the relation, the cause of law enforcement, let me put it that way. You know, they talk about defunding law enforcement. there's a lot of jobs we'd be happy to give up. Let me tell you, there are a lot of things that go on that we would rather have social workers, but there is no social workers at 2 in the morning, and there is no social workers when there's violence connected to it. So there's an awful lot of things we would prefer to give up. Mental health. How can it be that the Tinley Park Mental Health Center was closed? The south suburbs are the poorest suburbs probably in the state. How can you tell me that we should be? So they've been defunding things for a long time, and now we're very fortunate. We have a well-trained group of officers with our crisis intervention team. But how is it that the mental health center was closed? We don't understand that. Again, it's the south suburbs. So that has now fallen to the police to better handle it, to be able to identify mental illness, identify it, not to treat it, and to take appropriate action to try to get in most cases, you want a voluntary commitment if they exhibit signs that they might be a danger to themselves or others, because we know it's a better outcome rather than involuntary. But those things have fallen to the police, and in a better world, they wouldn't. They wouldn't fall to the police. There'd be more, but that's been defunded. So it's not the first thing that's ever been defunded, by the way. And training for police, you saw in Illinois, they passed a law that almost defunded much of our training from LA Law Enforcement and Training Standards Board. It was restored. It was restored, by the way. But training is one of the first things that suffers, and it's going to be a tough time ahead. You know, every department, municipality has a big budget hole now, and oftentimes training suffers a little bit, and that's the last place you want to have it suffer. So, you know, it was a tragic thing that happened. What followed up was tragic in many ways, too. There, you know, in Illinois, you know, chokeholds have been banned for 5 years. You know, chokeholds are not allowed here in Illinois. And fortunate, and, you know, so not that you can use a chokehold, you know, it's a life or death situation, but that was not a life and death situation whatsoever. So hopefully some good comes out of it. I hope there's not too much of an overreaction, but unfortunately, we brought this on ourselves.
Thank you for sharing that with me. And before I let you go, wrap a little bit about the importance of community policing. It's not just so that the community can come out and humanize police officers and see them serving up, you know, hot dogs and stuff like that. You know, it's a good time for them to communicate and get to know their officers. But it also seems to me a very important aspect of a police officer's own experience and training with the community where he gets to see the people that he or she will be serving throughout their career and humanize them as well.
Absolutely. And you want to meet them when it's not when you're writing them a ticket or not when they're in crisis, when it's, you know, just you and them and it's a very casual environment. And everyone is more likely to open up a little bit more, be a little bit more honest about, you know, hey, I had a bad time with one of your policemen, and maybe we can explain it, maybe we can't. So those are really great opportunities. And, you know, no police department is funded where you have a lot of policemen that you can pull off the street to even go to those things. You know, keep in mind calls for service come first. So when you have those opportunities, the beat meetings and that, you got to make the most of them. You really do, and get the most out of them that you possibly can, because there's not enough of them. You'd like to have more, but you got to have the police on the street and investigators doing investigations. But it's critical. It's important. You learn from it, and you're a better police department the more you interact with your residents and citizens in that casual environment.
You know, as people reexamine law enforcement's role in the community, you know, I think you hit it head on. You know, they're doing a lot of things that isn't necessarily a law enforcement's job, and not necessarily Orland Park, but in a lot of areas, you're sending in armed officers who may not have a good relationship with the community that they're serving, armed officers responding to things that should be dealt with by maybe a mental health professional or some other type of social servant.
Keep in mind that many times in most of our recruits are 24, 25 years old, don't have a lot of, oftentimes, some do, don't have a lot of real-world experience. Send them to the academy, you know, for 14, 16 weeks, put them through a field training program for 3 or 4 months, and we put them out in the street and expect they can handle some of the most critical issues in society that they get called to correct. And it's very difficult. It's often very difficult, and sometimes we expect too much. But what we expect them to do is to do it the right way. And oftentimes it doesn't work. It doesn't work, but at least do it the right way. So we expect a lot of them, and I think another problem in law enforcement is in the military, highly trained, well-equipped, go into combat, you know, are deployed for a year, they come back. They train, decompress. We put police out in the front lines for 30 years, and their only decompression is a two-week vacation here or there. And I don't think that's, you know, many professions have sabbaticals, and it's something we need to think about for police, too, to get them out of the front lines. They've been there too long. They've, you know, no matter what, they've seen too much. They need to get away from it. We need to decompress them and take some time to retrain them. But budgets don't currently allow for much of that to take place. And in some of our major cities, you know, Orland Park is different than the city of Chicago. We know that. But on the same token, when that's all they see day after day after day, you know, we have to understand that that has, you know, that can, for some people, it's no problem. Other people, it can become a problem, and we have to recognize that.
The one thing, you know, that just hit me is, you know, in all the TV shows and all the movies that, you know, maybe these young people that end up growing up into officers are watching, and maybe even within the law enforcement community, it's seen as a bad thing to be pulled off the street. And so, you know, maybe there needs to be something towards, you know, communicating or destigmatizing that it's not a punishment. It's just part of the gig.
It has to be mandatory. And you know, crisis intervention, you know, when people go through traumatic situations or critical incidents, it has to be mandatory because you're absolutely right. It's seen as a sign of weakness, so it has to be mandated. You have to do it, you know, and that takes away that stigma that you're talking about, that it seems like weakness. So it absolutely has to be mandatory to do. No other way around it. And that helps when you do it. And, you know, when you have critical incidents, it doesn't have to be a shooting, you know, bad crashes, really bad domestics and things like that. Sometimes you have to do that and just say, you know, where someone's been severely injured, that you have to go for critical incident debriefing. No doubt about it, you got to do it. So you're right about that. It's got to be mandatory.
You sound like someone from, you know, not only with a federal perspective, but a local perspective and a Chicago perspective, someone that I might be really good to stay in touch with to get opinions later on down the road of how things are going with departments across the country.
Sure.